vexations of life that are constantly happening as designed to keep us in practice for bearing great misfortunes, so that we may not become completely enervated by a career of prosperity. 7. Adversity as privilege. Or adversity may be viewed as a kind of honor or good fortune, because only some would be asked or able to rise to the occasion. Seneca on Providence 5:4. Toil summons the best men. The Senate is often kept in session the whole day long, though all the while every worthless fellow is either enjoying his leisure at the recreation ground, or lurking in a tavern, or wasting his time in some gathering. The same thing happens in the world at large. Good men work, spend, and are spent, and they do so willingly. Fortune does not drag them, they follow it and keep step. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:49. How unfortunate I am that this has happened to me. Not at all. Rather, how fortunate I am that, although this has happened to me, I am still unhurt, neither broken by the present nor dreading what is to come. For something of this sort might have happened to anyone, but not everyone would remain unhurt in spite of it. Remember, then, on each occasion that might lead you to grief, to make use of this idea. This is no misfortune. To bear it nobly, rather, is good fortune. 8. Humility in judgment. The Stoic does not easily conclude that any apparent reversal must be for the worse, even apart from the methods just described for turning adversity into good. It is hard to tell where an apparently bad thing will lead. Events that seem terrible when they happen sometimes result in greater things later. This may be because the process of recovery produces a result that surpasses whatever was destroyed. Or it may be because the later events lead, even fortuitously, to a new and better result in some way that was hard to foresee. The general point, we usually take a short-term view of developments we don't like, and are poor judges of what their ultimate consequences will be. Events that look bad should therefore be judged with humility and calm. Seneca Epistles 98:3-5. A man may be wise, he may do everything with precise judgment, he may attempt nothing beyond his powers. None of these desirable and precious things is of any use, unless you prepare yourself against the accidents of fate and their consequences, unless frequently and uncomplainingly and at every injury you will say, "The gods decreed otherwise." Nay, by heaven, let's try for a braver, truer note, and one by which you may better sustain your spirit. Say this every time something happens otherwise than as you expected. The gods decreed better. Seneca Epistles 91:13. Destruction has often made room for greater prosperity. Many things have fallen in order that they might rise higher. Timogenes, no friend to the city's happiness, used to say that fires at Rome troubled him for one reason only. He knew that better buildings would rise in place of those that had burned. Timogenes was a Greek teacher of rhetoric who was captured and made a slave by the Romans, then later set free. He evidently found himself in conflict with Augustus, which caused him to flee Rome. Musonius Rufus, Fragment 27. If you decide to try above all to have what is best for you, don't be annoyed at difficult circumstances, but consider how many things have already happened to you in life, not as you wanted, but as was best for you. Plutarch had a funny way of expressing this. Plutarch on Tranquility of Mind 6:467c. This, then, we should practice and work on first of all, like the man who threw a stone at his dog but missed and hit his stepmother. Not so bad, he said. For it is possible to change what we get out of things that do not go as we wish. Diogenes was driven into exile. Not so bad. For it was after his banishment that he took up philosophy. 9. Point of view. As we have seen elsewhere, much of Stoicism amounts to the art of perspective, that is, of finding the most useful point of view from which to look at anything that happens. The Stoic learns to see things from angles more helpful than the self-centered one that we are prone to use without reflection. As another example, Stoics respond to their own adversities by asking what they think when the same things happen to others. Epictetus and Chaeridion 26. If your neighbor's slave has broken his wine cup, it is common to say right away that these things happen. When your own cup is broken, your reaction should obviously be the same as when the neighbor's cup was broken. Apply the same idea to more important things. Someone else's child has died, or his wife. There is no one who wouldn't say, "This is our human lot." Yet when someone's own child dies, right away it's, "Woe to me, how wretched I am." We have to remember how we feel when we hear the same thing about others. Tver, The Moral Philosophy of the Stoics, 1585. Remember how you judged similar mishaps when they happened to others, and consider how you were hardly moved, and even blamed them, and brushed aside their complaints. The opinions we have of another man's cause are always more just than those that we have of our own. Smith's Interpretation of the Stoic View. Smith, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, 1759. We should view ourselves not in the light in which our own selfish passions are apt to place us, but in the light in which any other citizen of the world would view us. What befalls ourselves we should regard as what befalls our neighbor, or what comes to the same thing as our neighbor regards what befalls us. 10. Anticipation. The Stoics recommend that we think ahead about adversity. Anticipating it can take away its terrors and reduce its force when it arrives. Seneca Epistles 76:34. The wise man gets used to future evils. What other men make bearable by long endurance, he makes bearable by long reflection. We sometimes hear the inexperienced say, "I didn't know this was in store for me." The wise man knows that everything is in store for him. Whatever happens, he says, "I knew." Other translations render the last phrase as, "I knew it." In the original, it's just one word, "She'ebam," "I knew," and leaving it as shown seems to me better, but the reader might enjoy making the choice. Seneca, On Tranquility of Mind, 11:8-9. What can happen to one can happen to any, if a man will let this sink into his inmost heart, and if he will look on all the evils besetting other people, of which there is daily an immense supply, in this light, as if there is nothing to stop them from finding him too, he will arm himself long before he is attacked. It is too late to equip the mind for the endurance of dangers after the dangers have come. Military Analogies. Seneca, Epistles 18:6. In days of peace the soldier performs maneuvers, throws up earthworks with no enemy in sight, and is wearied by unnecessary toil, in order that he may be equal to that which is necessary. If you would not have a man flinch when the crisis comes, train him before it comes. Such is the course those men have followed who, in their imitation of poverty, have every month left themselves almost destitute, that they might never recoil from what they had often rehearsed. Montaigne of Solitude, 1580. It is enough for me, when favored by fortune, to prepare myself for its disfavor. And while I am at ease, and so far as my imagination can stretch, to picture future evils to come, just as we use jousting and tournaments to accustom ourselves to war and imitate it in times of peace. A famous anecdote of Anaxagoras was told by both Plutarch and Cicero. Plutarch, On Tranquility of Mind, 16, 474d to 474f. It is possible not only to admire the disposition of Anaxagoras, which made him say at the death of his son, "I knew that he was mortal when I got him," but also to imitate it, and to apply it to all that fortune may bring. I know that my wealth is ephemeral and insecure. I know that those who gave me power can take it away. I know my wife is excellent, but a woman, and that my friend is but a man, and by nature a changeable being, as Plato said. Those who are prepared and have dispositions of the sort, when something unwanted but not unexpected happens, refuse to accept the "I would never have supposed," the "I had hoped for other things," and the "I never expected this." They do away with the beatings and poundings of their hearts, as it were, and quiet down the madness and disturbance of their minds. Anaxagoras was a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, said to be the first to bring philosophy to Athens. Cicero, after telling the same story, comments, Cicero, Tusculan Disputations 3:14. There is no doubt but that all those things which are considered evils are the heavier from not being foreseen. The excellence and divine nature of wisdom consists in taking a near view of, and gaining a thorough acquaintance with, all human affairs, in not being surprised when anything happens, and in thinking that there is no event that has not happened that may not happen. Schopenhauer offered a theory to explain why foresight helps to blunt misfortune. Schopenhauer, Worldly Fortune, 1851. The main reason why misfortune falls less heavily upon us, if we have looked upon its occurrence as not impossible, and, as the saying is, prepared ourselves for it, may be this. If, before this misfortune comes, we have quietly thought over it as something which may or may not happen, the whole of its extent and range is known to us. But if no preparation has been made to meet it, and it comes unexpectedly, the mind is in a state of terror for the moment, and unable to measure the full extent of the calamity. It seems so far-reaching in its effects that the victim might well think there was no limit to them. In any case, its range is exaggerated. In the same way, darkness and uncertainty always increase the sense of danger. The Stoic advice to anticipate misfortune may seem in conflict with the Stoic advice to avoid worrying about the future. See Chapter 9, Section 4. The advice is best reconciled by holding that the rehearsals recommended above do not entail worry. Just as Seneca recommends savoring good memories and not rehashing bad ones, the Stoics encourage the rehearsal of future evils, but not anxiety about them. Schopenhauer also had a supplementary recommendation, not just to imagine what might be coming, but to imagine that it already came. Schopenhauer, Our Relation to Ourselves, 1851. There is some use in occasionally looking upon terrible misfortunes, such as might happen to us, as though they had actually happened, for then the trivial reverses which subsequently come in reality are much easier to bear. It is a source of consolation to look back upon those great misfortunes which never happened. 11. Pain and Opinion. The Stoics know that some kinds of distress can't be entirely dissolved by how we think about them, but they say that our reactions are still strongly affected by our judgments, by the ways we talk to ourselves, or our condition to respond. Pain is the most obvious example. You can't reason your way out of the sensation of it, but the Stoics think that our minds still have much to do with how the sensation is experienced and how it affects us. Seneca, Epistles 78:12-13. Don't make your ills worse for yourself and burden yourself with complaints. Pain is slight if opinion adds nothing to it. If, on the contrary, you start to encourage yourself and say, it's nothing, or certainly very little, let's hold out, it will soon leave off, then, in thinking it's slight, you will make it so. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:64. For most pains, let this remark of Epicurus also come to your rescue, that pain is neither unbearable nor eternal, if you consider its limits, and don't add to it in your imagination. Montaigne, that the taste of good and evil things depends in large part on the opinion we have of them, 1580. I willingly grant that pain is the worst hardship of our existence. I am the man on earth who most hates pain and avoids it, probably because I am so unaccustomed to it, thank God. Still, it is up to us, if not to eliminate pain, then at least to lessen it with patience. And even if the body is disturbed by it, to maintain our reason and our souls in sound condition. Montaigne adds a little later, it is with pain as with gemstones that look brighter or duller depending on the foil in which they are set. Pain takes up only as much space as we allow to it. The reader interested in more on this theme can refer back to Chapter 1, Section 3. 12. Adaptation. The Stoic understands, finally, that acceptance of adversity is helped by time. Another case of what we might now call adaptation, or the good and bad effects of familiarity, which the Stoics understand well. Adaptation isn't always beneficial. It can cause one to get used to bad things that ought to be fixed, or to good things that go unappreciated. See Chapter 13, Section 1 for some more discussion. But adaptation is unquestionably a great aid in making peace with adversities that cannot be helped. Most things that bother us when they arrive become more bearable once we are accustomed to them. The Stoic is mindful of this. Seneca Epistles 76:34. To those with no experience of it, a large part of any evil is its novelty. You can see this in the fact that, after getting used to them, they bear more bravely the things they once had regarded as harsh. Seneca on Tranquility of Mind 10:2. There is nothing for which nature deserves greater praise than this. Knowing the hardships to which we were born, it invented habit as a salve to disasters. We quickly accustom ourselves to even the severest misfortunes. No one could withstand adversity if its persistence were felt with all the same force as its first blow.
Chapter 11. Virtue. Much of Stoicism involves stripping externals of illusion and gaining detachment from them. But of course, Stoicism has an affirmative side as well, which many would regard as its most central and important idea, the pursuit of virtue. This topic could have come at the start of the book. It appears here instead because the Stoic meaning of virtue follows in part from lessons that by now we have considered. Virtue is the natural result of an accurate use of reason. Reason is the distinct gift that sets humanity apart from animals, so the purpose of human life must be found there. Earlier chapters have shown us much of what reason means to the Stoics. For one thing, and most relevant here, it should cause us to accurately see our individual insignificance, a theme of Chapter 3. And from this we might infer our corresponding place in the world, which is to function faithfully as parts of a whole. Stoics regard virtue as sufficient to produce happiness on all occasions, and also as necessary for it. The happiness centrally valued by the Stoic is eudaimonia, or well-being, the good life rather than the good mood. But the Stoic believes that virtue gives rise to joy and to peace of mind as well. Virtue produces these good consequences as side effects. The primary mission of the Stoics, in other words, is to be helpful to others and serve the greater good, and they don't do this to make themselves happy. They do it because it is the right and natural way to live, but doing it in that spirit, as it turns out, makes them happy. The Stoics, as we have seen, have various ways of advancing their views and making them persuasive. They attempt to base their ideas about virtue mostly on logic. The Greeks, in particular, sought to establish their ethical conclusions by a coherent system of deductions. They held that nature commands us to live in obedience to reason, and designed us to gravitate toward virtue. These often are viewed as among the less enduring arguments the Stoics made. That is partly because their view of nature as rational and providential is now shared by few. Critics have also complained of circularity in some of what the Stoics said. I don't propose to chase down those issues here, but will venture that the efforts of the Stoics to prove that we should pursue virtue, as they define it, are not likely to be compelling to anyone who is not already sympathetic to their claims. And yet, the Stoics' view of virtue is attractive in ways that can be separated from those doctrinal problems. Their belief about the relationship between virtue and happiness contains a good deal of psychological insight. Some states of mind are difficult to acquire directly. They come about only as byproducts of effort applied in other directions. Many have found that happiness is this way. Efforts to acquire it by direct pursuit don't work well. Happiness has to be found while looking for something else. This is a point often rediscovered in modern times with much fanfare. The something else proposed by the Stoic consists primarily of a dedication to reason and a commitment to others, to service, to justice, to helping in the ways one can. These are appealing values to live by, whether or not they are accompanied by a logical guarantee of their correctness. They also may be found a dependable path to happiness, or a more reliable one than any other. But recall that putting happiness aside just in order to find it later is cheating. Happiness is not supposed to be the Stoic goal, not even covertly. The Stoic view, rather, is that one should embrace virtue for its own sake, and that doing so is necessary to get the good side effects of it. The interested reader can reflect and experiment. This chapter, consistent with the rest of the book, and much as in Chapter 9 on Emotion, does not attempt to set forth the theoretical framework and taxonomy of virtue that the early Stoics developed. It shows in outline form, rather, the applied teachings of the late Stoics on the meaning of virtue, the benefits of pursuing it, and the value and cultivation of a few virtues in particular: honesty, consistency, and kindness. We also will see the importance that the Stoics assigned to involvement in public affairs and to being of service to others. 1. Definitions. The Stoics view virtue first as the use of sound reasoning and judgment. Seneca, Epistles 66:32. Virtue is nothing else than right reason. Seneca, Epistles 71:32. This may be taught quickly and in a few words. Virtue is the only good, or at least there is no good without virtue. Virtue itself is situated in our nobler part, that is, the rational part. And what will this virtue be? True and steadfast judgment. From this will spring the impulses of the mind. By this, every external appearance that stirs such an impulse will be reduced to transparency. Sound reasoning and judgment will in turn produce some specific qualities or virtues that the Stoic seeks, many of which have been discussed in earlier chapters. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5:5. They're not going to admire you for your quick-wittedness. So be it. Still, there are many other qualities about which you don't have to say, "I just wasn't born with it." So show them those qualities that are entirely up to you: sincerity, dignity, endurance of hardship, not pleasure-seeking, not complaining of your lot, needing little, kindness and generosity, being modest, not chattering idly, but high-minded. Don't you see how many you could display immediately, having no excuse on account of lack of natural capacity or aptitude, yet you still willingly fall short? Examples of the virtues that Marcus Aurelius valued can also be found in thanks he gives to others, such as his grateful entry about Claudius Maximus, a Roman consul, judge, and Stoic philosopher, who had been one of his teachers. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 1:15. From Maximus I learned self-government, and not to be led aside by anything, and cheerfulness in all circumstances, as well as in illness, and a just mixture in the moral character of sweetness and dignity, and to do what was set before me without complaining. He had also the art of being humorous in an agreeable way. Seneca saw the value of studying the liberal arts, among which he counted literature, music, and mathematics. There is a note about this in Chapter 7, Section 5. But he said they were all less important than philosophy because none of them taught its students the meaning of virtue. His exposition of the point provides an inventory of many virtues valued by the Stoics. Seneca, Epistles 88:29-30. Bravery is a scorner of things which inspire fear. It looks down upon, challenges, and crushes the powers of terror, and all that would drive our freedom under the yoke. Loyalty is the holiest good in the human heart. It is forced into betrayal by no constraint, and it is bribed by no rewards. Kindliness forbids you to be overbearing toward your associates, and it forbids you to be grasping. In words and in deeds and in feelings, it shows itself gentle and courteous to all men. Do liberal studies teach a man such character as this? No, no more than they teach simplicity, moderation, and self-restraint. 2. Benefits of virtue. Stoics regard virtue as the only source of true eudaimonia, a word that sometimes is translated as happiness, but, as noted at the start of the chapter, means something closer to well-being or the good life. Virtue gives rise to it as a side effect and brings about pleasure and joy as well. Epictetus, Discourses 1:4-3. If virtue promises good fortune, peace of mind, and happiness, Certainly also the progress toward virtue is progress toward each of these things. Seneca, in turn, elaborated on the tranquility or peace of mind associated with virtue. Seneca on Tranquility of Mind 2:4. What we want to discover, then, is how the mind may always maintain an even and favorable course, may be well disposed toward itself, may be happy in contemplating its own condition, and may have this happiness without interruption. How it can stay calmly in that position, never carrying itself off and never cast down, this will be peace of mind. Seneca Epistles 59:16. Here is the result of wisdom, a constant and unvarying kind of joy. The mind of the wise man is like the heavens beyond the moon. The sky up there is always clear. This joy is produced only by a consciousness of the virtues. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 8:1. You know from experience how far you have wandered without finding the good life anywhere, not in logic, not in wealth, not in fame, not in pleasure. Nowhere. Where is it found, then? In doing what human nature wishes. How is that done? By having principles that govern your impulses and actions. What principles? Those concerned with what is good and evil. That there is nothing good for man except what makes him just, moderate, brave, and free, and nothing evil except that which produces the opposite. The Stoics emphasize, though, that in their view, virtue is not pursued for the sake of the good consequences it brings. Those consequences are welcome and prized, but nevertheless are incidental. Seneca on the Happy Life 9:1-2. But you too cultivate virtue, he replies, only because you hope to gain some pleasure from it. First of all, even though virtue will assure pleasure, it is not on account of pleasure that virtue is pursued. It is not pleasure that it assures, but pleasure as well. Nor does virtue exert itself for pleasure, but its effort, though it aims at something else, achieves this too. Thus pleasure is not the reward or cause of virtue, but the byproduct of it. Compare the general conclusion of John Stuart Mill, which he thought was an accurate account of how most people work. Mill, Autobiography, 1873. Those only are happy, I thought, who have their minds fixed on some object other than their own happiness, on the happiness of others, on the improvement of mankind, even on some art or pursuit, followed not as a means, but as itself an ideal end. Aiming thus at something else, they find happiness by the way. Mill elsewhere described the writings of Marcus Aurelius as the highest ethical product of the ancient mind. 3. Honesty. Various Stoic virtues, such as moderation, have been examined in other parts of the book. We now consider some that have not, beginning with honesty, not just speaking the truth, but living without hiding anything, on openness of action. Epictetus and Chaeridion 35. When you have determined that something should be done and are doing it, do not hide it from others, even if most of them will not approve. If it isn't the right thing to do, then don't do it. But if it is, why be afraid of those who will criticize you wrongly? Seneca, Epistles 43:3-4. Count yourself really happy when you are able to live in public, when your walls protect rather than hide you. Though for the most part we regard our walls as around us not so that we may live more safely, but so that we may sin more privately. I'll tell you a fact by which you can judge our conduct. You will scarcely find anyone who could live with this door open. See also Epicurus, Vatican Sayings 70. Let nothing be done in your life that will cause you fear if it is discovered by your neighbor. Montaigne of Repentance, 1580. It is a rare life that maintains its good order even in private. Everyone can play his role and act the honest man on the stage, but to be well managed within, in his own breast, where everything is allowed and where everything is hidden, that is the point. The next closest thing is to be this way in your house, in your ordinary behavior, for which you are accountable to no one, and where there is nothing studied or artificial. On openness of mind, or keeping to thoughts that one wouldn't be embarrassed to admit. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 3:4-2. A person should accustom himself to think only those things about which, if someone should suddenly ask, "What are you thinking about?" he might answer this and that, frankly and without hesitation. Seneca, Epistles 10:5. The madness of men these days! They whisper the most shameful prayers to the gods. If anyone is listening, they fall silent. But they don't want anyone to know they tell to God. See if this wouldn't make a wholesome rule. Live among others as if God were watching. Speak with God as if others were listening. Montaigne, Upon Some Verses of Virgil, 1580. I have enjoined myself to dare to say all that I dare to do. I am displeased even to have thoughts that I would not publish. The worst of my actions and qualities do not seem to me as vile as the vile cowardice of not daring to own them. 4. Consistency. The Stoics had a test for virtue, and perhaps a shortcut to it, consistency. Consistency sounds like a quality that has nothing to do with substance. It might seem as easy to be consistently bad or wrong as consistently virtuous. But consider the relationship between consistency and the openness of thought and action described in the previous section. True consistency would mean always thinking the same thing is right and never deviating from it. It also would mean acting and thinking the same way in all settings, in public, at home, and alone. Never phony. For phoniness may accurately enough be described not only as dishonesty, but as a form of inconsistency. Someone who managed to be consistent in the senses just described would, the Stoic suggests, inevitably be virtuous. Seneca, Epistles 25. To abandon the old definitions of wisdom and use one that covers the whole range of human life, I can be content with this. What is wisdom? To always want the same things and reject the same things. No need to add that little qualification, so long as what you want is right, since one could not always be pleased with the same thing if it were not right. Seneca, Epistles 120:19-22. This is how a foolish mind is most clearly shown. It appears now as one thing, now as another, and worst of all, in my opinion, it does not appear as itself. Believe me, it is a great thing to act as just one person. Montaigne, Of the Inconstancy of Our Actions, 1580. It is a hard matter from all antiquity to pick out a dozen men who have formed their lives to one certain and constant course, which is the principal design of wisdom. 5. Love, kindness, compassion. These are underestimated themes in Stoicism, and so are worth illustrating at some length. What follows will be instructive in its own right, and also as something to show to those who think of Stoicism as a cold or sour thing. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 6:39. Adapt yourself to the circumstances you have drawn, and the men among whom your lot has fallen, love them, and truly. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 11:1-2. Further characteristics of the reasoning soul are love of its neighbors, truth, compassion, and valuing nothing above itself, which is also the property of law. Thus there is no difference between correct reasoning and just reasoning. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 11:18. Kindness is invincible, if it is genuine and not insincere or put on as an act. Epictetus Discourses 3:2-4. I should not be unfeeling like a statue. I should care for my relationships both natural and acquired, as a pious man, a son, a brother, a father, a citizen. Seneca on Anger 1:5-3. Our common life is founded on kindness and harmony. It is bound in a compact of mutual assistance, not by fear, but by love of one another. Seneca, Epistles 5:4. This is the first promise that philosophy holds out to us: fellow feeling, humanity, sociability. Seneca Epistles 47:11. Treat your inferiors as you would be treated by your betters. The translation of the passage just shown is attractive, but liberal. The original shows more clearly that Seneca was thinking about how people live with their slaves. Seneca Epistles 103:3. Keep an eye on one man to avoid being hurt, on another to avoid hurting him. Rejoice in the happiness of all, and sympathize with them in their misfortunes. Remember what you should take upon yourself and what you should guard against. Seneca on Anger 3:43-5. So long as we draw breath, so long as we live among humans, let us cherish humanity. Let us not cause fear to anyone, nor danger. Let us rise above losses, outrages, conflicts, and taunts. Let us bear our short-lived ills with magnanimity. Seneca Epistles 1:15-3. If we were able to examine the mind of a good man, what a beautiful sight we should see! How pure, how astonishing in its noble calm, bright with justice and strength, with moderation and wisdom. In addition to these, thrift and moderation and endurance, kindness and affability, even humanity, a quality, hard as this is to believe, rarely encountered in humans, would add their own brilliance. Seneca on Mercy, 2:5, 2-3. People object that the Stoic school does not allow the wise man to be compassionate or forgiving. These propositions are detestable on their face. They would seem to leave no hope for human failings, but to make all transgressions lead to retribution. And if that were so, what kind of theory is it that commands us to unlearn our humanity and blocks the mutual assistance that is our surest refuge from ill fortune? But in fact, there is no school more kind and gentle, none more affectionate toward humanity, none more concerned with the common good, to the point that its avowed purpose is to be of service and assistance, to have regard not only for oneself, but for each and for all. We have seen Seneca and Marcus Aurelius refer to the value of compassion. That is a nuanced topic for the Stoics. Their philosophy calls for a felt sense that all of humanity are their relations. It also calls for help to those who need it. But the Stoic does not favor compassion in the different sense of feeling sorry for other people and making their sadness one's own. That is, becoming despondent because others are despondent. Seneca's position was that good Stoics will do all that would be done by anyone who feels pity for others, but that they will not feel the pity themselves. Pity is considered a form of distress that serves no purpose and impairs good judgment. Seneca on Mercy 2:6, 1-2. Sorrow is not suited to seeing things accurately, to understanding how to get things done, to avoiding dangers, or to knowing what is just. So the wise man will not indulge in pity, because there cannot be pity without mental suffering. All else that those who feel pity are inclined to do, he will do gladly, and with an elevated spirit. He will bring relief to another's tears, but will not add his own. To the shipwrecked man he will give a hand. He will give shelter to the exile and charity to those in need. In chapter 13, we will see a similar sentiment from Epictetus. In the meantime, Montesquieu's conclusions. Montesquieu, The Spirit of Laws, 1748. Never were any principles more worthy of human nature and more proper to form the good man than those of the Stoics. And if I could for a moment cease to think that I am a Christian, I should not be able to hinder myself from ranking the destruction of the sect of Zeno among the misfortunes that have befallen the human race. It carried to excess only those things in which there is true greatness, the contempt of pleasure and of pain. It was this sect alone that made citizens, this alone that made great men, this alone great emperors. While the Stoics looked upon riches, human grandeur, grief, disquietudes, and pleasures as vanity, they were entirely employed in laboring for the happiness of mankind and in exercising the duties of society,
It seems as if they regarded that sacred spirit, which they believed to dwell within them, as a kind of favorable providence watchful over the human race. Born for society, they all believed that it was their destiny to labor for it. With so much the less fatigue, their rewards were all within themselves. Happy by their philosophy alone, it seemed as if only the happiness of others could increase theirs. 6. Interdependence and service. The Stoic regards human lives as interdependent, and finds in this a source of duty, affection, and solace. Seneca Epistles 48:2. Nor can anyone live happily who has only himself in view, who turns everything to his own advantage. You want to live for the other fellow, if you want to live for yourself. Seneca Epistles 95:51-53, quoting Terence, the self-tormentor. Why should I list everything that is to be done and to be avoided, when I can give you the duties of mankind in a rule of few words? All this that you see, including both the divine and the human, is one. We are limbs of one body. Nature made us kin, since she gave birth to us from the same substance and to the same ends. She put into us love of one another and made us social beings. She constructed fairness and justice. According to her dispensation, it is more wretched to harm than to be harmed. In obedience to her command, let our hands be ready where help is needed. Let that famous line be in your heart and in your mouth. I am human. I consider nothing human foreign to me. Let us hold things in common. That is how we are made. Our society is just like an archway of stones, which would fall if they did not block each other. It is held up in the same way. Epictetus, Discourses 2:5, 25-26. What are you? A man. If you look at yourself in isolation, it is natural to live to old age, to be rich, to be healthy. But if you look at yourself as one person, and as part of a given whole, for the sake of the whole, your turn may come to be sick, or to run risks on a sea voyage, or to be in need, perhaps to be put to death. This interdependence has significance for how we live and spend our time. The Stoics understand themselves to have a duty of service to others, including a duty to participate in public life. Cicero's rendition of the Stoic view, Cicero on the Ends of Good and Evil, 3:20. Since we see that man is designed by nature to safeguard and protect his fellows, it follows from this natural disposition that the wise man should desire to engage in politics and government, and also to live in accordance with nature by taking to himself a wife and desiring to have children with her. Even the passion of love, when pure, is not thought incompatible with the character of the Stoic sage. Seneca had a pithier version of what is expected from the Stoics, those in the sect of Zeno, as Montesquieu called them. Seneca on Leisure, 2:2. Epicurus says, the sage will not engage in public affairs unless he must. Zeno says, the sage will engage in public affairs unless he cannot. That translation is again a bit free, this time to keep the two halves of it parallel, which is irresistible. But what is meant by public affairs? Not just politics, but helping others on whatever scale is available, large or small. Seneca on Leisure 3:5. It is, of course, required of a man that he should benefit his fellow men, many, if he can, if not a few, if not a few, those who are nearest, if not these, himself. For when he renders himself useful to others, he engages in public affairs. The Stoics also take a broad view of what it means to benefit others. Philosophizing counts, and they have a broad understanding, too, of the relevant others they are bound to serve. They did not view those in their immediate communities or their country as the only ones who matter. Everyone does. Epictetus, Discourses 1:9-1. When asked what country you are from, do not say, I am Athenian, or I am from Corinth. Say, like Socrates, I am a citizen of the world. Epictetus, Discourses 2:5-26. For what is a man? A part of a state?
first of one that consists of gods and of men, then of the state to which you more immediately belong, which is a miniature of the universal state. Seneca on Leisure, 4:1. Let us grasp that there are two commonwealths, the one, a vast and truly common state, which embraces alike gods and men, in which we look neither to this corner of earth nor to that, but measure the bounds of our citizenship by the path of the sun. The other, the one to which we have been assigned by the accident of birth. Some yield service to both commonwealths at the same time, to the greater and to the lesser. Some only to the lesser, some only to the greater. Chapter 12. Learning. Stoics are students not just of Stoic doctrine, but of the process of learning how to practice it. They view the philosophy as an approach to daily life, not an intellectual edifice to be enjoyed from outside or visited from time to time. This chapter thus offers comments on what in the study of Stoicism is realistic and what isn't, what helps and what doesn't, and where to look for encouragement. Stoicism offers some exercises for those trying to follow its advice. Review of each day, and where one made philosophical mistakes or did well. Imagining oneself being watched by an idealized figure, and asking what the watcher would think and say, and meditating on the principles of Stoicism until they sink in. The Stoics also offer views about the value of solitude and of social life, comparing the ways that either can help or hinder progress in wisdom. Above all, they stress that progress in the philosophy is not made by knowing its precepts. It is made by assimilating them, and by thinking and acting accordingly. Stoicism is, among other things, a regimen for training the mind. If that sounds too hard, the Stoic would say it is because we aren't used to taking that task as seriously as we take the training of the body. Everyone knows that the path to becoming an accomplished athlete involves time and commitment. So does progress in Stoicism. Its methods are especially challenging because the mind is the trainer as well as the thing trained. It has to teach itself to do better. The Stoic looks at things from a point of view that differs from the automatic one, and seeks to resist the conventional reaction to whatever may happen. This all requires steady attention and energy, but it also gets easier with time. We might think of Stoicism, as Seneca will suggest, as the equivalent of a demanding martial art. It takes practice. In return, the philosophy offers improvement in peace of mind, in fearlessness, in well-being, and in wisdom. 1. Review. The Stoics offer many techniques for improving the quality of one's thinking. In other chapters, we have seen some of them, such as changes in perspective, or anticipation of the worst that might happen. But Stoicism also offers meta-techniques, that is, techniques for getting better at the techniques. One of them is to set philosophical goals and keep track of progress in reaching them. Epictetus, Discourses 2:18-12. If you wish not to be quick to anger, don't feed your habit. Don't throw it fodder on which to grow. As a first step, keep quiet, and count the days on which you didn't get angry. I used to get angry every day, then every other day, then every third, then every fourth. If you can quit for 30 days, make a sacrifice to God, for the habit is loosened at first, then totally destroyed. A similar suggestion is nightly review of how the day went from a Stoic standpoint. Seneca on Anger, 3:36, 1-3. The mind should be summoned every day to render an accounting. Sextius used to do this. At the end of the day, when he had withdrawn to his nightly rest, he would interrogate his own mind. Which of your wrongs did you correct today? Which fault did you resist? In what way are you better? Anger will leave off and be more moderate, if it knows that it must each day come before a judge. Is there anything finer than this habit of searching through the entire day? When the light has been removed, and my wife, long aware of my habit, has become silent, I scan the whole of my day and retrace all my deeds and words. Sextius was a Roman teacher of Stoic and Pythagorean philosophy, who lived a generation before Seneca did. He founded a school in Rome that was later run by his son, the School of the Sextii, and that lasted from about 50 BC to 19 AD. We gather from Seneca's letters that he attended the school when he was young. See Chapter 8, Section 3. Seneca kindly supplied a model of the daily accounting to oneself suggested above. Seneca on Anger, 3:36-4. See that you don't do that again. I'll pardon you this time. In that discussion, you spoke too aggressively. After this, don't get into arguments with ignorant people. If they've never learned, they don't want to learn. You criticized that one fellow more candidly than you should have. As a result, you didn't correct him, you just offended him. From here on, watch out. Not so much that what you're saying is true, but that the person you're talking to can understand the truth. This recommendation of daily review is sometimes described as Pythagorean. Schopenhauer, Our Relation to Ourselves, 1851. The advice here given is on a par with the rule recommended by Pythagoras, to review every night before going to sleep what we have done during the day. To live at random in the hurly-burly of business or pleasure, without ever reflecting upon the past, to go on, as it were, pulling cotton off the reel of life, is to have no clear idea of what we are about. And a man who lives in this state will have chaos in his emotions and certain confusion in his thoughts, as is soon manifest by the abrupt and fragmentary character of his conversation, which becomes a kind of mincemeat. And the Stoics also will engage in a reverse sort of review, preparation for what is coming. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 2:1. Begin the morning by saying to yourself, "Today I will meet with the busybody, the ungrateful, and the arrogant, with the deceitful, the envious, and the unsocial. All these things result from their not knowing what is good and what is evil. But I have seen the nature of the good, that it is beautiful, and the nature of evil, and that it is ugly, and the nature of him who does wrong, and that he is akin to me, not because he is from the same blood and seed, but because he partakes of the same mind and the same small bit of divinity. I cannot be injured by any of them, because no one can involve me in anything ugly except myself. And how can I be angry with my kin or hateful towards them?" That passage may be studied with profit by academic administrators. Seneca had offered a similar suggestion. Seneca on Anger, 2:10-6. The wise man is calm and even-handed in dealing with error. He is not the enemy of the mistaken, but corrects them. And as he goes forth each day, he will think, "I will meet many who have given themselves over to wine, many who are lustful, many ungrateful, many greedy, many who are driven by the madness of ambition." He will view all these things in as kindly a way as a physician views the sick. 2. Watching. Another Stoic exercise in adjusted perspective, adopting a doubleness of mind, and so observing oneself through the eyes of an imaginary other. Establishing an external point of view and personifying it is a way to see what you are doing more objectively and hold yourself to higher standards. Seneca, Epistles 11:8-10. We must single out some good man and have him always in view, so that we may live as if he were watching and do everything as if he saw it. Choose the one whose life, whose speech, whose forthright countenance all satisfy you. Then show him always to yourself as your guardian and model. We need someone, I say, against whose example our own conduct can measure itself. You can't straighten what's crooked without a ruler. Seneca, Epistles 25:5. It helps, no doubt, to have appointed a guardian for oneself, to have someone you can look to, someone you regard as taking part in your thoughts. The most noble thing by far is to live as if you were being seen by some good man who was always present. But I'm satisfied even with this, that you do whatever you do as if someone were watching. It's when we're alone that we are prompted to evil. Epictetus described the dialogue one might have with such a watcher. Epictetus, Discourses, 1:30, 1-3, 5-7.
When you are going into the presence of some man in authority, remember that another is watching what is happening from above, and that it is not the man, but the other you must satisfy. So the watcher inquires of you, exile, prison, bondage, death, disgrace. What did you call these in the lecture hall?
I called them indifferent.
So now what do you call them? Have those things changed at all?
No.
Have you changed then?
No.
Well then, go in confidently, remembering these things, and you'll see what it means to be a young person who has studied, among those who have not studied. By the gods, I expect you'll feel something like this. Why do we make so many elaborate preparations for nothing? Is this what power means? The fancy entrance, the attendants, the bodyguards? Was it for this that I listened to so many lectures? These things were nothing, and I was preparing as if they were great.
3. Meditation.
Sometimes Stoicism is helped by just contemplating it, and by reading and writing. It is both a way of life and a way of thought. Rehearsal of accurate thinking is how one practices Stoicism and how one improves at it.
Seneca Epistles 16:1.
It is clear to you, Lucilius, I know, that no one can live happily or even tolerably without the study of wisdom. Wisdom, when achieved, produces a happy life. Wisdom only begun still makes life bearable. But this idea must be strengthened and driven deeper by daily study. It is harder to stick to the resolutions you have already made than to make noble new ones.
Seneca Epistles 94:42-43.
Good maxims, if you keep them often in mind, will be just as beneficial as good examples. Pythagoras says that our minds are altered when we enter a temple, see the images of the gods close at hand, and await the utterance of some oracle. And who will deny that even the most ignorant may be powerfully struck by certain sayings? Statements such as these, concise but weighty, nothing to excess. No wealth can satisfy the covetous. You must expect others to treat you as you treat them.
Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5:16.
The character of those things you often think about will be the character of your understanding, for the mind is dyed by its thoughts. Dip it, therefore, in a succession of thoughts such as these. For instance, that where it is possible to live, it is also possible to live well.
Epictetus, Discourses 1:1-22.
I must die. So must I also die regretting something? I must be put in chains. Must I also be wailing about something? I must be banished. Does anyone prevent me from leaving with a smile, cheerful and easygoing? Reveal your secrets. I don't speak. This much is up to me. Then I will put you in chains.
Man, what are you saying?
Me? You can chain my leg, but Zeus himself can't overcome my will.
I'll throw you in prison.
My poor body, you mean?
I'll cut your head off.
When did I ever tell you that my neck was the only one that could not be severed? These are the things philosophers should think about, should write down daily, should use as exercise.
4. Places.
The Stoics do not always take identical views of the places one goes and the company one keeps, and how choices about them bear on philosophical progress. Perhaps the answers depend on the details. Seneca acknowledged that some locations are more suitable than others for the development of wisdom.
Seneca, Epistles 51:2-3.
Just as some clothes suit the wise and honest man better than others, and though he does not dislike any particular color, he thinks some of them inappropriate for one who has adopted the simple life. So there are places the wise man, or the one aiming at wisdom, will avoid, as not conducive to good living. Thus, if he is contemplating a retreat, he will never choose Canopus, though Canopus will not prevent anyone from being virtuous, and certainly not Baiae, which has become a den of vice. Canopus was a city of the coast of Egypt. Baiae was a town in the southwest part of modern-day Italy, near Naples. Both were ancient resort areas famous for debauchery. Notwithstanding the challenge presented by such places, the usual attitude of the Stoics is skepticism about the importance of being in one place rather than another. They regard life as lived in the mind more than at any physical site,
and view the appetite for new locations as arising from the same source as the appetite for other new things. Our sensibilities are too dull to appreciate what is around us already. Epictetus Discourses 2:16-32. So when will I see Athens again, and the Acropolis? Wretch, isn't it enough for you, what you look at every day? Could you have anything better or greater to see than the sun, the moon, the stars, the whole world, the sea? Compare Cicero's remark, Cicero on the Nature of the Gods, 2:38. Now, if we should be suddenly brought from a state of eternal darkness to see the light, how beautiful would the heavens seem! But our minds have become used to it from the daily practice and habituation of our eyes, nor do we take the trouble to search into the principles of what is always in view, as if the novelty, rather than the importance, of things ought to excite us to investigate their causes. The Stoic is less interested in changes of scenery than in changes of the self, and regards the first as unlikely to be pleasing without the second. Seneca Epistles 28:2. How can the sight of new countries give you pleasure? Getting to know cities and places, that agitation of yours turns out to be useless. Do you want to know why your running away doesn't help? You take yourself along. Your mental burden must be put down before any place will satisfy you. Horace also gave expression to this idea. They change their climate, not their disposition, who run beyond the sea. Horace, Epistles 1:11. Emerson offered a well-known expression of it too. Emerson, Self-Reliance, 1841. We owe to our first journeys the discovery that place is nothing. At home, I dream that at Naples. At Rome, I can be intoxicated with beauty and lose my sadness. I pack my trunk, embrace my friends, embark on the sea, and at last wake up in Naples. And there beside me is the stern fact, the sad self, unrelenting, identical, that I fled from. I seek the Vatican and the palaces. I affect to be intoxicated with sights and suggestions. But I am not intoxicated. My giant goes with me wherever I go. And Plutarch used a similar example as an analogy to describe superficial changes of all kinds that don't help us. Plutarch on Tranquility of Mind 3, 466b to 466c. Like people at sea who are cowardly and seasick, and think that they would get through this voyage more comfortably if they should transfer from their little boat to a ship, and then again from the ship to a man of war. But they accomplish nothing by the changes, since they carry their nausea and cowardice along with them. In the same way, changing one's way of life or its opposite will not relieve the mind of the things that cause it grief and distress. These are ignorance of affairs, thoughtlessness, the inability and the not knowing how to make proper use of what is at hand. These are the defects which, like a storm at sea, torment rich and poor alike, that afflict the married as well as the unmarried. Because of these, men avoid public life, then find their life of quiet unbearable. Because of these, men seek advancement at court, by which, when they have gained it, they are immediately bored. 5. Solitude. The Stoics view solitude as having similarly mixed attractions. On the value of it. Seneca, Epistles, 94:69-71. Solitude in itself does not teach integrity, nor does the countryside give lessons in moderation. But those vices whose object is show and display will subside where no witness or onlooker remains. Who puts on the purple robe when he has no one to show it to? Who serves a single dinner on a golden plate? No one is elegant just for their own benefit, or even for a few close friends. We set out the implements of our vices in proportion to the crowd there to see them. So it is. The stimulus of all our extravagance is the complicit admirer. You will cause us not to desire things if you keep us from showing them off. Ambition and luxury and lack of restraint all need a stage. You will heal them if you are kept from view. On the Needlessness of Solitude, Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:3. They seek out retreats for themselves, places in the country, seashores, the mountains, and you too are accustomed to crave such things especially. All this is utterly amateurish, since it is possible to retreat into oneself any time you like. On the risks of it, Seneca, Epistles 10:1-2. They say that Crates, a disciple of that Stilpo I mentioned in an earlier letter, when he saw a young man walking by himself, asked him what he was doing there alone. "I am conversing with myself," he said, to which Crates replied, "Watch out, I beg of you, and listen carefully. You are conversing with a bad man. No ignorant person should be left alone. That is when they make bad plans and create future troubles, either for others or for themselves. It's when they organize their ignominious desires. Whatever the mind once concealed, whether from fear or from shame, it now reveals. It sharpens boldness, stimulates lust, goads anger." Stilpo was a Greek philosopher born in the 4th century B.C. As Seneca mentions, he was a teacher of Crates of Thebes, a member of the Cynic school. Stilpo and Crates, in turn, are both credited as teachers of Zeno of Sicium, the founder of Stoicism. All three are heroes to the Stoics. 6. Good and bad company. Stoicism regards us as here to work with others. So while Stoics are very alert to the hazards of social